The next matter on for oral argument this morning is Stillwell on behalf of the minor child versus Stillwell. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of those timing restrictions. They're indicated in the light and clock in the lectern, which for your convenience, there's a button in front you can raise or lower to match your height. It should be easy to find there. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument for the benefit of the public audio recording that we're taking of the proceedings. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to go, you have the floor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Chantel Pye, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Harry Stillwell. In this case, the petitioner sought an order for protection to prevent Mr. Stillwell from encountering their daughter, AGS, within their small community. Paragraph 6 of the district court's order excludes Mr. Stillwell from traveling on 9 miles of County Road 110 and 15. The effect of this travel restriction is to exclude Mr. Stillwell from his community. He can't attend church, he can't visit friends, he can't visit his doctor, and he can't visit clients of his insurance business. This remedy exceeds the district court's authority under the Domestic Abuse Act. Subdivision 6 of the Act lists the available remedies. In relevant part, the district court can issue an order for protection that excludes the abusing party from a reasonable area surrounding a dwelling or a residence, and that's paragraph 6A3. Or under paragraph 6A13, the district court can order other relief as it deems necessary for the protection of the petitioner from domestic abuse by the alleged abuser. The district court didn't explain which portion of the Domestic Abuse Act it relied on to support the travel restriction. But at the district court, the parties argued solely over whether paragraph 6A3, which allows a district court to issue an order excluding an abusing party from an area surrounding a residence or dwelling, allowed for an order that surrounded roadways. Now on appeal, petitioner adds that the district court might have had this authority under paragraph 6A13. Paragraph 6A13 is a catch-all that gives the district court authority to order other relief as it deems necessary. Nothing in the record suggests the district court intended to rely on this paragraph.
What difference does that make? I don't think the district court cited, I don't know if it did or didn't, subparagraph 3. I mean, but if it had the authority, it had the authority. Whether it puts that specific paragraph in there or not, does it not?
That's true, Your Honor. But the Domestic Abuse Act is a legislatively created remedy that sets out particular remedies that are available. And so the district court's findings need to match the authority that it's relying on. So if it was relying on paragraph 6A3, the test is a reasonableness test, which requires balancing the interests of the safety of the petitioner against the intrusion on the liberty of my client. Or if the paragraph is, or if the district court was relying on paragraph 6A13, the district court needed to find that relief was necessary to protect the petitioner. In either instance, this fails, but it's a question of what we're reviewing here. And without knowing which paragraph the district court was relying on, this court can't adequately review the findings.
So it might just be a sufficiency of the findings as opposed to the authority of the district court.
That's fair, Your Honor, in that it's about the sufficiency of the findings as tied to the paragraph of the statute the district court was relying on.
So for example, just to be certain of your argument, under paragraph 13, sort of the catch-all, if, for example, in a given OFP case, the protected party might attend therapy at their therapist's office, something that's not otherwise covered in a geographic restriction, you're not arguing that a district court couldn't, under paragraph 13, preclude the abusing party from being within 100 feet of the protected person's therapist or something like that, therapy office?
Not at all.
Okay.
The district court has that authority under paragraph 6A13. The district court just needs to find that that's a necessary restriction to protect the petitioner.
And what isn't, as we look at this record, I mean, it was the evidence that followed the agreement to entry of an OFP clearly was around the either a radius or these roadways. I mean, that's what the testimony was all about. So it seems, I guess, not a mystery that the scope, that the request involved and that the your client testified to the impact of a road-based exclusion in order to preclude the daughter from encountering her father, right? So, I mean, we know what this was about by reading the record. Do we not, to stop encounters within the town of Mound?
It's true that that was the petitioner's intent, was to stop encounters within the town of Mound. What that means...
Because of the impact that they have on the daughter.
Because of the impact that they have on the daughter.
Right.
What that means, though, is that the district court couldn't have been relying on paragraph 6A3, which is surrounding a residence. So the plain language of the statute in paragraph 6A3 says that the restriction may be surrounding a residence. This restriction, as issued by the district court, surrounds towns and roadways. So when the purpose was to exclude my client from the towns and roadways, we find ourselves in paragraph 6A13. Paragraph 6A13 sets a higher substantive standard. The district court needed to find the restriction necessary to protect the petitioner from the domestic abuse. That language of the statute requires some tying of the restriction itself to the abuse at hand. And this is where the district court's order is not supported by the record. So
even if the court had found, for example, we were to remand and say these findings aren't sufficient, and the court said, okay, I'm going to review the record here. Yes, here's the reason I'm doing it is because of the impact on the daughter in the places that she frequents within her town, and particularly just along the main part of Mound and down over to the school, up to the home, and across the other part of County Road 15. Therefore, that's the reason I'm doing it. It's necessary to protect her because encountering him, and that's where she is, and she's a kid, and that's her life, and
encountering him there is
so traumatic for her. You're going to turn now into the argument, I think, that the court couldn't find that is necessary. Is that right?
I think a court could find that is necessary, but the court finding that is necessary would need to tie the necessity to the domestic abuse. So here at the end of the November hearing, my client's attorney moved for a directed verdict, and then there was argument over the scope of the domestic abuse. Petitioner, and this is the September 2023 hearing, petitioner raised arguments that my client showering with his daughter 10 years ago was domestic abuse, and the district court found that there was sufficient evidence to show domestic abuse based only on that incident. The district court didn't consider, there's some other generalized allegations of stalking or encounters in public. The district court didn't consider those at that point.
But at this point, we're talking about the petition itself. If we look at the petition, the original petition, it alleges the domestic abuse. It also alleges stalking behavior, right, and like some interaction in the car, et cetera. That's all in the petition that's at issue here. And your client, or it's represented by his counsel, that while he disagrees with the allegations in the petition, he's agreeable to allowing entry of an order for protection without findings made of domestic abuse. And then he requests that it be a quarter mile, and then we know that there's discussion about it, and then we have testimony. Why, if you look at the petition, that he's not challenging those factual allegations in the petition, which included behavior up until this time, why wouldn't that behavior be properly considered in determining the relief?
So my client's decision to consent to be treated as if there was a finding of abuse here came in the context of the district court's hearing. At the end of the district court's hearing.
Which district court hearing?
So at the end of the September 2023 hearing.
On what topic? On this topic?
On this
the first
topic.
Day of this.
The first day
okay.
of this petition, gotcha. Yes. At the end of that hearing, there was a motion for a directed verdict, and the district court ruled that there was sufficient evidence of domestic abuse based solely on allegations of sexual misconduct. After that point, my client consented to be treated as if there was a finding of abuse. But he only consented to be treated. In doing so, he continued to contest that the geographic restriction was in a reasonable distance around a dwelling. That was the only legal basis the petitioner had at that point for the geographic restriction we're challenging now. There's nothing in the district court orders or in the district court record suggesting that this was about the necessity of the petition under paragraph, or the necessity of that geographic restriction under paragraph 6A13.
And to be clear, so I understand your argument, at the end of the first day of the hearing, you're saying that the district court made a ruling on all the allegations in the petition, like a final ruling about whether all the allegations in the petition were proved? Or was it making a decision related to whether to do an ex parte order? Or it sounds like you're saying it already decided that there was no evidence except for the original domestic abuse that happened in the home. Is that right?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that the district court made that finding, as you said. My client moved for a directed verdict. Mm-hmm. At that point, all of the argument was on the topic of sexual misconduct. In denying my client's motion for a directed verdict, all of the argument at the district court was about that particular incident. And so when my client consented to be treated as if there was a finding of abuse, that was the scope of abuse at issue.
You've asked us to remand, to have the district court remove the geographic restriction. Given what you've argued about the ambiguity in the district court's basis for its decision, why wouldn't we remand for the district court to clarify its order and enter new findings?
I think that would be fine, Your Honor. My client's asking for this court to reverse the restriction and remand to the district court for further proceedings as necessary. If this court would find it helpful for the district court to clarify its basis, that's also...
Would those further proceedings include possibly allowing the district court to reopen the record for additional evidence?
Absolutely. My client doesn't oppose that.
But it does sound like, because I don't want you to not have your fair argument here, that you think that, at least on the record here, a district court could not order. So in other words, if we just didn't reverse but remanded for explanation, that's not a disposition you're okay with, or you are okay with it?
I don't think this court can remand without reversing this particular order or this particular paragraph. So we're talking about just paragraph 6 of the district court's order. The remainder would stay in place. And the reason is that I agree with you, Judge Smith, that on this record, there's not sufficient factual basis to support the geographic restriction. And there are several reasons for that. The district court didn't find that my client posed any current threat or danger to AGS. The district court did not find that abuse was likely to recur here. The district court denied petitions for ex parte relief two prior times. And then in September 2023, the district court issued an emergency order for protection that didn't include the travel restriction. After that point, there are no allegations of Mr. Stillwell encountering AGS. So based on those facts, it seems that the travel restriction was already sufficient to protect AGS. And at the hearing, Ms. Ostergaard herself testified that she thought that at a minimum, Mr. Stillwell should be excluded from just one intersection on Highway 10. So testimony at the hearing supports a conclusion, the only conclusion, that a lesser restriction was adequate to protect AGS. Where a lesser restriction is adequate to protect the petitioner, the broad restriction is not necessary to protect the petitioner. So by the plain language of the statute, the facts at the hearing just don't support a conclusion that this restriction was necessary to protect AGS from domestic abuse, particularly where, as here, the record reveals that the domestic abuse that petitioner was concerned about was primarily allegations of sexual misconduct that occurred 10 years ago.
But your client did agree to entry of an order for protection.
He did, Your Honor.
And I think to say there's an absence of findings of a current threat and no finding that it's likely to recur, I mean, he agreed to the order for an OFP, to an OFP, and he agreed not to challenge the factual allegation. So it seems perhaps not fair to fault the district court for not making findings about the existence of a current threat or that it's likely to recur, because that seems to go to the whether you could even have a restriction around the residence at that point, you know? I mean, if he agreed to the facts and he agrees to an OFP, it seems all about just the scope of it.
So he agreed to be treated as if there was a finding of abuse. He continued to contest that this particular restriction was a restriction surrounding a residence or dwelling. That's the only arguments that came up about this restriction at the district court. This necessity argument is a post hoc justification that's come up only in appeals briefing now. So on the first point, this is plainly not a restriction surrounding a residence or dwelling. It surrounds roadways and it covers three towns.
Can I ask, with the 4 miles that was at issue, 4 miles versus a quarter mile at the start of the point where your client said that testimony would be helpful, does the 4 miles encompass the actual sort of upside down T that ended up being the restriction here?
It doesn't encompass the entire T, no, Your Honor. So I don't have an exact overlay, but it encompasses portions of it. So
does it encompass the main intersection in Mound between 110 and 15?
I believe it does.
Okay, and the high school?
Yes, and there's a separate restriction surrounding the high school here that's not challenged.
Okay.
I see my time is expiring.
I have one additional question. Would we have to look outside the record to determine the impact, the breadth, and the area that you're alleging would be impacted by the geographic restriction?
The impacts on my client?
Well, not the impact on your client, but the given the language of the restriction, would we have to look at, say, a map to determine the impact on the area?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's allowable? Is that map in the record?
There were exhibits presented at the district court. I've been unable to access those exhibits despite reaching out to the district court, and my understanding is that this court doesn't have the exhibits either. I wasn't counsel at that point, so I don't have them, and I apologize that I can't answer that question directly.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Jill Brisbois, B-R-I-S-B-O-I-S. I represent this respondent, Beth Ostegard-Stillwell, on behalf of the party's minor child. This case concerns the safety and well-being of a young girl that has suffered profound emotional and psychological abuse due to her father's behavior. The core issue before the court is the reasonableness of the district court's decision to impose a protective geographic restriction against Harry Stillwell. As the court will recall, AGS has experienced significant trauma, including sexual abuse at the hands of her father, regardless of when it occurred. And she also continues to suffer distress due to his stalking behavior in the community. These encounters have exasperated her anxiety, panic attacks, and suicidal ideations. She has been unable to engage in routine activities like attending school, walking her dog, because her fear is constantly triggered by his presence. The district court's decision to impose a distance restriction as a measured response to the ongoing trauma was correct.
Is there evidence in the record to establish that the scope of the geographic restriction was necessary?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, there is significant discussions. If you will recall from the record, what had occurred was after the first criminal case was dismissed, there began to be those encounters on the road. The first one, I believe, was December 9th. The next one was December 12th. And then there were a number of other occurrences that occurred, I believe, in May. I know there was for sure one on May 16th, which is the day that Lexi turned 16. There was an incident before that. There were another number of other instances that were talked about but weren't specifically proven at trial. As the court can see from the record, this was a very lengthy trial for an order for protection hearing, and so we limited it to specific instances. But there are a number of instances in the record that talk about where these contacts were happening and why we needed that distance restriction. And specifically, what would happen is, as Beth Stillwell testified, as they would go to school, as they would leave their neighborhood, they would encounter him on these roads, and that's when Lexi would have these panic attacks. You will also see from the record there was the instance with the law enforcement officer after the school was released, where he encountered Lexi having a panic attack on the roadway. And so there's a number of different instances where you can see where that geographic restriction was in fact necessary. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Okay, thank you. Your Honor, I just want to go back and, or Your Honors, I want to go back and talk about a discussion that was being had with Mr. Stilwell's attorney. September 25th was the first portion of the trial. After we concluded that day, we were still going on in trial. The court denied Mr. Stilwell's request to dismiss the case. Then Mr. Stilwell took the stand and began testifying. It became clear we were not going to conclude that day, and that is when the judge issued the ex parte order. That was not the first time I was seeking an ex parte order. I sought an ex parte order that passed December. I sought another ex parte order in May when we were having all those issues with contact. But we then came back in November. Mr. Stilwell continued testifying. It was not until he was about to be cross-examined by me that he consented to the entry of the order for protection. And at that point is when we began trying to deal with the distance restriction. My original petition, I believe, asked for either a mile or 2 miles. I apologize, I can't remember off the top of my head. We then came to the court and then asked for 4 miles on an ex parte request. That was denied. I then filed a request to amend the petition to ask for a 4 mile request. And that is then where we ended up on that November date, taking additional testimony about what should be this restriction. I was obviously advocating for a 4 mile restriction, but the court asked me to come up with an alternative proposal. We spent a lot of time and energy in a courtroom with a lot of confusing maps and trying to figure that distance restriction out. It was confusing, and to say the least, but that is what happened after Mr. Stilwell, mid-testimony, consented to the order for protection. It wasn't at the end of that September date. It was when he was about to be cross-examined about his conduct that he finally consented.
Maybe I misunderstood. I'm sure you're right. I thought it was at the start of his testimony.
Oh, no. It was not.
No, start of his testimony on day two. You're saying that he gave some direct testimony on day two?
Day two, yeah. Okay. So we were there all morning. We were dealing with some motion practice that isn't relevant to this. He did testify that morning. And then I think at that point, his counsel at that time did, in fact, rest. And then we came back after lunch. I was going to begin cross-examination, and that's when he consented to the order, entry of the order. It was also represented that he would maybe be calling other witnesses. But I think that distinction is important here because it wasn't as the result of the court taking this protective measure after listening to evidence on September 25th that he consented to the entry. It was after he got to say what he wanted to say and then didn't want to have to talk to me.
May I ask, there's a map of that was submitted in page 12 of the appendix brief.
Yep.
That would captured the order as written. And the part that goes from 110 to the east, so the right-hand sort of extension, you know, from Mound to Navarre.
I'm trying to pull it up here. And is it in the response? Okay, yeah.
Sorry, and the appellant, I think it's the appellant's brief.
I have it. Can you?
Yeah. So you know, I there was a lot of testimony, I think, about 110 and the intersection about 110 and 115. There's testimony about when you go west about this on the way to the school, et cetera. It was not plain to me, but maybe you know, whether there was testimony taken about sort of 110 to the east, that leg of it. Was that part of the discussion? It was a little bit, like you say, it was hard to get all the numbers and everyone's trying to figure it out. Was that leg of the restriction part of the discussion?
Is it in the record? Absolutely. That is part of the record. I would have to go pull up the transcript, and I can certainly point you out to the general portion of it. But again, that was certainly part of the discussion. This ultimate map that we're looking at here is what we were proposing and what we were taking testimony and making arguments about on that afternoon in on that date in November. Okay. And, you know, just, and I believe it's in the record, and I apologize if I'm not accurate on that, but what is to the east is the majority of where Lexi would go to church, go to her, she has a dog, that's where her dog stays when she's in school. There's a number of other things that she does in that area. As you look at the map, going to the west, kind of that lower part, that's what leads to her school. And then the 110, again, is where she lives. And I just want to emphasize, Lexi can't leave her little neighborhood without using 110. So there, you'll see from the record, there are many times in which she goes to leave her neighborhood, in particular on her 16th birthday, and there her dad is driving right by as she's leaving. I believe the record also talks about she was trying to walk her dog on 110, and there he is driving. And so she just can't go about her normal life without seeing him. Again, I was asking for a 4-mile distance restriction that would have removed him from his house. The court did consider all of these issues and came up with a very appropriate solution to this problem that, you know, to this day remains ongoing. I apologize, I lost where I was at. There are two cases out there that talk about distance restrictions, or two specific cases that talk about distance restrictions. The first one is Courtney versus McReynolds. The other one is D'Antoni versus D'Antoni. In D'Antoni versus D'Antoni, that was a 4-mile restriction. It was different than this particular case because Mr. D'Antoni no longer lived in that particular neighborhood. However, in Courtney versus McReynolds, that I believe was a 1-mile distance restriction, but those facts are different than the case that we have here today. In the case that we have here today, one of the primary ways in which this abuse is ongoing is by these continual contacts within that particular community, and those contacts cause Lexi fear of immediate bodily harm. That is within the record, and that is domestic abuse under 518B. So when we talk about there was just the sexual abuse from, you know, years earlier, domestic abuse is ongoing. There is the video in the record where Lexi goes to the orthodontist and is waiting in the car for her brother, and Harry Stillwell is circling around her, and you can hear on the video, I think he has a gun, I think he's going to hurt me. And so that is fear of immediate bodily harm. And so to suggest that this is protecting somebody from an event that occurred years earlier is not correct. This is ongoing domestic abuse day in and day out. Every time she sees him, she cannot figure out why he is continuing to follow her around when he states that he is concerned about her safety. But again, going back to Courtney versus McReynolds, in that case, while McReynolds in that case was outside of that geographic restriction where they thought they could see him at the house, a lot of his behaviors were sending messages and making other types of threats. What we have in this case is the abuse is happening by the stalking behavior that is happening when Lexi is out trying to live her everyday life.
Do you think that would you disagree with the idea that there is a necessity, or do you think there is a necessity for a district court to make findings, not on the abuse, because that was either find it in a contested case or you accept the party's concession to it in a given case, or at least not challenging it? But is there a need for findings that connect that abuse with the ultimate relief, such that on appellate review we can review whether there's an abuse of discretion in determining that the relief is necessary? I ask about that because I'm not sure, although I can read the record, what the conflict was and what the evidence is going to is the impact on the respective parties. When you look at the order itself, it imposes it without further discussion.
It imposes it, but I think it's supported by the record. I think, I'm thinking about your question as a practical consideration. Mm-hmm. Let's just step away from this case and we think about OFPs day in and day out. How many OFPs and HROs are we seeing day in and day out where people are consenting to the entry of an OFP and a HRO without findings, mm-hmm. and there are a number of conditions that go along with those OFPs and HROs. And what I think Mr. Stilwell's counsel is suggesting and your question is asking me about is when we say, okay, you can't go within a block of the school, do we need the district court making findings as to why that's particularly necessary in this case? And is that what we want to do? I'm not sure if we want to do that, but I think regardless of, you know, this policy question of, you know, do we need to prove up, why are we having this, you know, restriction about don't fly drones over somebody's house? Do we need adequate record on that? If somebody's consenting to the entry of the, you know, OFP or HRO, I don't think it should be necessary. I think the parties know what they're agreeing to when they agree to that, and that's where things went awry here is that Mr. Stilwell consented to the entry of this order for protection, but he wanted it his way. And I had pled out this case in a very particular fashion that addressed all of the remedies that I was asking for, and including that four-mile restriction. And so then when the judge asked me, do you agree to this quarter-mile restriction, my answer was no, we are seeking something further because of all of these other issues. But again, I don't think it should be necessary if somebody's consenting to the entry of the order for protection that the court should then have to make another step and say each one of these remedies that I'm issuing is supported by this particular evidence because that defeats the purpose of, you know, consenting to these entries. Does that answer your question?
Thanks.
Yeah. Your Honor, I just want to talk, Your Honors, I want to talk about this distance restriction request came after respondent explored a number of alternatives, and those are in the records. This includes asking Harry Stilwell to avoid certain routes. You can see the Our Family Wizard messages where she's saying, please avoid these routes. Ms. Stilwell took different routes, modified her own travel behavior. She had Lexi lay down in her car. She had Lexi covering her face when they rode in the car so that if they saw her dad, she wouldn't become upset. We've tried everything. We tried everything. And when it didn't work, we went back to the court and said, we need this increased restriction because this problem is ongoing. And all these other ways were ineffective. And this is the only way to solve this problem. I'm asking you to affirm the court's distance restriction. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for Appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. Judge Smith, you asked if the district court needs to connect the necessity to the ultimate finding. In Courtney v. McReynolds, which is an unpublished case, this court said that we cannot affirm when the district court did not explain the extraordinary expansion so far from the residents in relation to the safety concern. So this court has previously required district courts to make some explanation of how it complied with the statutory requirements, and that's all we're asking for here. There's also older case law, including Andrasco, where the court has specifically required factual findings. And most recently, the context of a post-conviction petition in Waiters, just a few months ago, the Supreme Court explained the importance of having factual findings from a district court for the court to review, or for an appellate court to review. So the district court needed to make some factual findings. I just want to note briefly that petitioner still hasn't offered any argument that this is surrounding a residence. I understand in the context of the hearing that this restriction was come to through an agreement, but it's still not a restriction surrounding a residence. And it's not necessary to protect AGS from domestic abuse. Domestic abuse is defined in Subdivision 2 of the statute. It's defined by reference to the alleged abuser's conduct. The statute says that domestic abuse is defined as committing a physical act, the infliction of fear of physical harm. Each of these requirements requires some conduct by the defendant. Here, petitioners effectively alleged that my client was driving in the community where he lives.
Well, there's an allegation of stalking, sort of not just driving, but an allegation of deliberate contact, visual contact with your client.
The allegations are that AGS is perceiving my client, Your Honor. So the allegations are that AGS saw him driving around. I realize there are allegations of stalking here, but the district court didn't make any findings about the pervasiveness of the stalking. And where is the case here after the September 2023 ex parte order? There were no allegations that that order was insufficient. The court can't affirm a finding that it was necessary to include this far more invasive travel restriction when lesser restrictions were already sufficient to protect.
Do you agree that stalking in this case, which results in fear, could constitute domestic abuse?
Yes, Your Honor. Stalking is a form of domestic abuse, and we're not alleging otherwise. What we're saying is that the district court needs to find that there was stalking and connect the act of stalking to the necessity of the restriction to protect the petitioner from the act, and we don't have that here. And then I just briefly want to address the reasonableness. To the extent that the district court was issuing this order under paragraph 6A3, which permits a reasonable restriction around a dwelling, the record shows extreme intrusions into Mr. Stillwell's rights. He can't go to church. He can't travel within his community. He can't visit clients of his business. The reason for this extreme intrusion is to protect AGS. AGS's safety among three different cities where it's not clear from the record that she actually goes. And even Ms. Ostergaard identified at the hearing that some lesser restriction would be sufficient to protect AGS. Ms. Ostergaard herself testified that just one intersection, the intersection on 110 where AGS goes to leave her home, would be sufficient. So for these reasons, we ask the court to reverse and remand to the district court for further proceedings to apply the plain language of the Domestic Abuse Act.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel, Ms. Pye and Ms. Brisbois. Well done. We appreciate your oral argument and your briefing. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you both, and have a good day.